what's going on when all them guns is drawn? Here's a memo. Remember, there's a few wars going on, a couple overseas and on my front lawn, when common sense was common and now it's all gone. What's going on? And that's going on. And what's going on? And that's going on. And what's going on? And that's going on. And that's going on. And that's going on.
Out of New Orleans, it is the Dirty Dozen Brass Band with Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, vocals by Public Enemy's Chuck D. It's a title track of their 2006 album, A Post-Katrina Protest Against Governmental Inaction, Indifference, Malfeasance, and Failure. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. The Ferguson Commission, a 16-member blue ribbon panel appointed last November by Missouri Governor Jay Nixon to look into underlying causes of the rebellion that enveloped the city 3 months earlier after the shooting of Michael Brown by police, concluded its task 2 days ago with a 198-page report titled Forward Through Ferguson, A Path Toward Racial Equity. The report makes about 169 recommendations in four key areas that it identified as requiring urgent attention: law enforcement and the criminal justice system, issues related particularly to local youth, economic development, and entrenched racism. Our guest, Al Gerhardstein, a Cincinnati-based civil rights attorney with a long history of successfully litigating police brutality cases and forcing court-ordered reforms in the criminal justice system, is here with us today to discuss not just the Ferguson Commission report, but the implications of the report. And I thank you so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, you've had a chance to take a look at this report, but before we get into the report itself, when a report is issued and under these circumstances, based on your experience, do you automatically have some reservations?
Well, sure. I mean, this is a blue ribbon panel, and at a very cynical level, you could say that this is what the people in suits do to placate the masses, because they gather right after there's a disturbance. They have meetings, and they invite people to vent, and they drag it out for months, and then they issue what sound like really good ideas, but then there's no follow-through. So that's the cynical view. I hope I'm totally wrong, and I hope this commission has got a way out of their current situation so that these things actually get implemented. But my experience in Cincinnati was that we went through 13 of these blue ribbon commissions in the first 20 years of my litigating against the city. And at the end of our riot in 2001, we knew that we were not going to leave the table until we had a court order. And that's what we needed, but maybe Ferguson will have a different mix.
What could you talk a bit about your specific history here with regard to how these commissions are formed, what they actually intended to do, and how you had to combat that and develop a strategy to achieve the goals that you initially had wanted?
Well, let's talk about police issues particularly, because this Ferguson Commission is much broader, and I don't want to sweep other things in. When it comes to policing, my clients have been the people on the street, the African-American community, the urban poor, and they felt over-policed. They felt occupied, and they were, because in Cincinnati, for the first 20 years of my practice, from like 1978 through the late 90s, police were doing zero-tolerance policing, stop-and-frisk, sweeps, strategies that basically treated all black people as suspects and that disrespected them and didn't really follow their Fourth Amendment rights, and it just made people angry. The hit rate on stop and frisk is so low that it just makes you feel like you're just being abused. So when we got to the, and we had had a series of shootings of African-Americans who were unarmed, 15 African-Americans in the late 90s, early 2000s, that caused a real need for dramatic reform. And we filed a class action lawsuit alleging excessive force, racial profiling, and other abuses, and consolidated 14 lawsuits against the city, but offered an alternative. One thing I had learned through those 13 Blue Ribbon Commissions was that the constituency for police reform is actually much broader than the people in a lawsuit. And what we said in our case was, sure, we can go to court, we'll get a preliminary injunction, we can fight you in adversarial ways, but here's another alternative. And we used the conflict resolution expert, and we said, why don't we have a community-wide dialogue that brings in all the stakeholders in the city who have a stake in policing? And why don't we include the police union as a separate party at the table? And let's try and come up with some shared values about policing. And in the end, there are two giant things that end up happening in these cases. Number one is the police are told to stop abusing people. And they do that, and there are orders that say use of force must be reformed, accountability must be improved, citizens' complaint must be implemented. There should be an early warning system so that we catch those people who are drifting, and there should be bias-free policing and strategies to track that. That's the traditional end that the DOJ always gets. But we added something different in Cincinnati, and that was a commitment to problem solving, a whole different philosophy of policing that says rather than come in and sweep everybody up, when there's a hot spot, rather what we'll do is we'll study why crime is attracted to that location. And we'll gather all the stakeholders. We'll have the business owners, the landlord, the residents, the different city departments, highway maintenance and lighting and sewer and anybody else who could help change that environment. And we'll work together to change that physical location if that's the issue. And we'll do it without increasing arrests and without locking up more black people. And that's what we've been implementing for the last few years, and it's working. Crime is going down, arrests are going down, and people are trusting the police more. And that's what we're trying to emphasize.
Well, this is one of the fundamental differences here with the Ferguson Commission report, in that even the members of this commission agree and admit that the report has no teeth, no legal teeth at all. There is no way for the recommendations that they put forward on the table to be required. There's no way for them to enforce anything that they have recommended. So the question becomes, was this, I mean, I don't want to sound cynical, as you have, you started out saying you don't want to sound cynical either, but is it just on the basis of hope that they engaged in this exercise, or what do you think, having produced a report, do they now have to go through the second round to find out whether their recommendations are going to be taken seriously or whether there is going to be some mechanism to enforce what they are recommending?
Yeah, so I actually think there are a few nuggets here that they could seize on to make sure these recommendations get implemented. And let's pause for a minute. And I think there are a lot of good recommendations. So they've done a good job of studying. They have named the problems correctly. I think that if you could just implement a lot of these things, we'd be in much better shape. But how can that happen? Well, first of all, they don't sunset the commission until the end of December. So they left themselves some time to follow through on their calls for action and shake their finger at the various stakeholders and say, all right, step up. Let's do what we need to do. And one of those parties that have been identified is the state, I forget what they call it, the training academy for all the police in the state. And that's critical. Contrast that with Ohio. Ohio, we just did a statewide commission for use of force reform and have just issued a new report. And our police training academy will implement those recommendations by requiring all the officers to be trained to those standards. So that's a good statewide vehicle for upgrading the style of policing and the sensitivity and the cultural competency of policing through their training academy. And that is something the governor can order. That's something that can have statewide impact pretty quickly. And now they have a few months to put a spotlight on that group and say, what are you going to do? Some of these other things that require more participants they'll have to go to these various bodies. They have something like 90 different governmental bodies within St. Louis County. So there's a lot of people there. But you have St. Louis County itself, St. Louis the city, that can take action to adopt these things. And I would focus on those big players and try to make sure it gets done. Now, there's one other thing going on in that area that I think will help. We know that the Justice Department is negotiating with the city of Ferguson. And if the final consent decree ends up looking anything like the DOJ findings and the recommendations in that findings letter, then you are going to have an excellent template in that one court order that will be supervised by a court. So you'll have both the Ferguson Commission report saying this is what we ought to do because it's right, and you'll have a court order with respect to Ferguson saying if we don't do it, this is what you're looking at. And maybe that'll spur action across that region, and I hope it does.
Well, the bottom line still remains where this commission starts and where the Justice Department starts and where the governor starts in this matter is on the establishment of the fact that nobody so far has secured justice. None of these entities has secured justice in the shooting death of Michael Brown. The Justice Department has said, well, you know, the threshold of for prosecution is very high at the federal level. The state basically said there is no reason to indict. The governor refused even to appoint a special prosecutor. So basically, I'm reading the report as yet another admission, an official admission, that they can do nothing or will do nothing about the central, what seems to me to be the central question here, which is in the particular instance that this whole thing is predicated on, that's the shooting death of Michael Brown by then police officer Darren Wilson. Where is the justice here? Is that all parties agree that that is no longer the issue and let's move, as they say, let's move forward, unquote?
Well, in any of these, controversies, there is a trigger. And the Michael Brown shooting was certainly the trigger. But it's not a trigger unless there's gunpowder laying around, unless there's a combustible group of problems. And the commission report, the DOJ report, the Arc City Defender lawsuit, all point to a much broader set of problems even than the single shooting of Michael Brown. I mean, that's municipal court system in Ferguson and in those other Jennings and those other towns was way out of control. That was not a law enforcement vehicle at all. It was a money-raising effort, and people were getting dragged into court just to squeeze them for every little dime in order to fund the local communities, and that's not the role of a court. And I'm very glad to see that through the Arc City Defender lawsuit and the state legislation that there'll be a cap, a much lower cap on how much money you can raise out of the municipal court. So I think there will be some systemic reform on some of the abuses that are highlighted as a result of the unrest that followed the Michael Brown killing. And I don't think that the local community is left totally high and dry. But sure, the family of Michael Brown isn't addressed at all in this Ferguson Commission report. I haven't talked to their lawyer. I don't know what the status of the civil rights lawsuit is.
But neither has the fundamental question of the functioning of the prosecutorial system, the functioning of the prosecuting attorney, the local prosecutor in this case. And all of these things are, to me, very, very important to address, because this is the system. I mean, I don't deny that there are larger issues as well. There are major issues contributing to this rebellion that was triggered by the shooting death of Michael Brown. But I'm still saying that we have no answer, even from this commission or anybody else, we have no answer about the killing of Michael Brown. In fact, the report says that's not what they're there to do. They're not there to investigate the Michael Brown shooting, and they're not there to address it. They're there simply to pay attention to, or call to our attention, the underlying or related issues that were raised in the aftermath of his death. And it seems to me that that itself is the first and most massive concession. And there was where the work really needed to be done. If only, of course, I could appreciate they're not investigators, but the question, the systemic response here by the criminal justice system, by the prosecutor's office, because we had suggestions here of prosecutorial misconduct. We had suggestions here of the governor's indifference. We had the suspension of citizens' rights because we had martial law declared. We had the militarization of police. We had the so-called five-second rule, where young men, most of them black, would be arrested if they stayed around too long, for more than 5 seconds, in a public place. We had innumerable arrests on very specious grounds. So all of these things, to me, suggest that this was to be a major focus of the commission. And I'm startled that I didn't see the commission pay attention to these things at all.
First of all, with respect to whether the commission should have investigated the details of the shooting of Michael Brown, I guess I'll disagree with you. Let's assume that I was representing the family of Michael Brown. At some point, I want to get everybody else out of it. I'll let the local criminal system do their investigation, then the Justice Department does its investigation, and then I'll bring my civil rights lawsuit. And I'll have subpoena power, and I'll be able to do everything I need to do to prove my case. And I won't be delayed by any more people, investigating things once it's... And I just think this commission wasn't set up, and it doesn't bother me that they weren't set up to be yet another quasi-criminal investigatory body. I think they were set up to do a broader review of the conditions that led to the unrest and to the killing. And I do think there's a role for that type of effort. I know that when I do my police misconduct cases and when I do the collaborative in Cincinnati with all my colleagues and clients, we were litigating a narrow issue in the middle of a much bigger problem. Poverty of the urban situation, and I would welcome somebody looking at the context of the work we're doing in police reform, and I think the Ferguson Commission is doing that. none of that takes us to the place where we can be sure that any of this will get implemented. And on there, I totally agree with you. I think we won't need, you know, I don't know if it's shaming, if it's making sure the press doesn't get fatigued. I don't know how to make sure that these bodies take seriously some of the solid recommendations that have been made.
Well, I don't disagree with you at all and in that respect, but I was raising the question because they are, in fact, looking at systems that are failing and that are having inordinate impact and consequences for the majority African-American community in Ferguson and all the people of Ferguson, for that matter. But because this is so symptomatic of what is happening in the Fergusons of America, one would have thought that part of the thinking on with the commission would be that they understood that they were doing something that would have been of seminal value in outside of Ferguson. It is no news, frankly, when you look at the report, it's no news that the things that they have cited are unique to Ferguson. I mean, it's no news at all. Not unique to Ferguson. What they are describing is in this specific instance of investigating the underlying causes and the related causes, that's fine. But we have seen this before. And frankly, it bolsters my point, which is that federal agencies, state agencies, governmental agencies all know this. I mean, they got their statistics and figures from governmental agencies and people who've been dealing with this for years. So that somebody knows these things. Here was an opportunity, it seems to me, for them to strike a blow, to say that part of the systemic failure here is in the functioning of the prosecutor's office, and there should be questions raised about the conduct of the, although they're not supposed to, I understand they're not supposed to investigate this case anew, but I think it would have been a great help to raise questions about the conduct of this investigation under the prosecutor, the conduct of the governor himself in provoking a rebellion, the question about suspension of citizens' rights under martial law. How do you suspend people's rights and declare a state of emergency even before an emergency occurs or exists? This is interesting. And some of the questions that pertain to just your civil rights, day-to-day civil rights, and how they are handled in Ferguson, because how they handled in Ferguson so closely resembles how they're handled in Cincinnati and how they handled in New York City. So I thought they missed an opportunity here to extend that investigation into these areas, only because it would have opened the door for commissions similar to this to begin to link to not exempt these systems from blame. They have major blame to account for in the provocation of this rebellion and in the consequences thereafter.
I do notice that the commission did call out the conflicts of interest among the prosecutors, which is good to see. And the commission does call for reform in the way that demonstrations are policed. And, of course, we do have the ACLU lawsuits, which are ongoing, about the five-second rule and the other, the tear gas and the other demonstration lawsuits, which hopefully will help rein in some of those abuses. But I don't want the reaction to the commission simply to be, and I participated in this, so I know I'm part of it, what they could have, should have, and didn't do. Because they did do a fair amount. They did come up with some solid recommendations, which if they were followed, would improve the civic dialogue, improve fairness to people of color, and improve awareness and action around disparate people of disparate income. And somehow, I hope that their calls to action are heard and some of this gets implemented, because it would be a shame if we, if those on the progressive side say, well, they didn't do enough in their recommendations and then don't help energize the effort to at least implement what they did name, because there's some good stuff there.
Well, let's talk about some of the good stuff. What do you consider some of the good stuff in this report?
Well, for one thing, they have called for the consolidation of some of the police agencies and consolidation of some of the municipal courts. I think that would be very, very helpful to prevent the use of the municipal courts as just a money-grinding machine. They call for the creation of civilian review boards, which are very important at the local and county level. And those have to be, and there was a review of what a good review board includes, and that's supposed to have subpoena power and other things. They call for the development of a comprehensive demonstration response plan so that there's good rules of engagement and people are trained to that in the various law enforcement agencies. They call for sentencing reform so that there's less abuse of sentencing and, you know, just these warrants that constantly keep people labeled as criminals when they're minor offenses. I mean, some of those things are really solid. And the overuse of the criminal system for minor traffic and other violations, it's directly related to the over-incarceration of black people across the country. And the commission has called for the decriminalization, a lot of the minor offenses that the municipal courts are dealing with. So I think that's all good stuff. I think that's important. When it comes to some of the other stuff I like was the appointment of counsel for minors. I think that's a very important thing, because too many kids are just waiving their counsel and they end up getting sucked into the criminal justice system without proper protection. And I think that when it comes to police reform itself, the training increases, the cultural competency calls, the use of force reforms that they've called for. I didn't see explicitly a lot of talk about problem solving, but I think it's included in some of the ways that they're talking about changing policing. I'd like to see a little bit more effort on problem solving. I think those are all important calls to action that would improve the quality of life for people in that urban setting.
You're the founder of the Ohio Justice and Police Center, which litigates and advocates for criminal justice reform. What would you say are the critical issues that you encountered in Cincinnati, but that you have found in your capacity as founder of this organization that basically pertain or all throughout the United States, especially in communities of color?
Well, you know, it's a great question. The Ohio Justice and Policy Center has been working since 1997 and calling for a thorough examination of the over-incarceration of people of color. And only now, at this time in our history, are there conservatives and progressives on the same page. And, I mean, you hear Rand Paul, you hear Ted Cruz. I mean, these are people that I don't agree with on just about anything. And yet, on criminal justice issues, they're starting to see that we have some common ground, and they're starting to see that the way we have labeled those things that are criminal, the way we've enforced our drug laws, the way we've made our discretionary choices around arrest, around diversion, around who gets locked up and who gets a second chance, all have racial disparities. And we're breaking up black families, and we are making it harder and harder to actually have intact black families because of our racially biased criminal justice system. So I'm excited that right now we may see some reforms, and they should go well beyond the reduction in the disparity of sentencing between crack and powder cocaine. I mean, we need to do a lot more to look at how our laws are enforced. And there's a whole series of measures that OJPC has been advocating, that Ohio's looking at, and that I guess some of these libertarian slash conservative leaders are also going to be looking at. There are bills in the federal government, in the Congress, as well as in the state legislatures, that might well reduce the number of people that we lock up, and that's an exciting time. I hope people tune into this, because I do think the dialogue is shifting.
You currently are representing the family of Sam Dubose in a really outrageous case. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'm working with Mark O'Mara and Michael Wright as counsel to the family of Sam Dubose, and that is the case where the University of Cincinnati police officer was, I believe, engaged in some racially biased policing around his traffic stop. 82%. First of all, I didn't understand why a UC police officer is policing Cincinnati streets off campus. That's an issue we definitely have to address. His philosophy of policing collides and contradicts what we do in Cincinnati with our city police officers. But he's out there doing this traffic stop for missing license plates, and you can just tell through the dialogue that he is very suspicious, accusatory of the driver, and then actually opens, on this minor misdemeanor, opens the driver's door. If you're an African-American in urban America and some police officer is opening your door and all he's accused you of is missing a front license plate, you think you're going to get beat up. And you can just see it on the body cam. So the driver, Sam Dubose, closes the door and starts his car, because he's going to leave. He doesn't need this. And then the officer shoots him in the head. And the officer has absolutely no beef. Even if Sam would have driven away, this is a time to disengage. This is not a time to treat him like a felon. The car didn't move at all before the officer is shooting at him. And it's horrible. Even the University of Cincinnati, which released a report last week, the Kroll report, which concluded that the officer was totally wrong in his conduct. And, of course, the officer has been indicted by our local prosecutor and grand jury for murder, which is highly unusual, which is good that the criminal justice system is going to hopefully work in this instance. But it is an example of, if you have contiguous police departments and the UC Police Department has full police power, it is very important, if you're going to let a neighboring agency's police department police on your street, that you need to have a memorandum of agreement that makes sure that they police using the philosophy that we worked so hard to establish in Cincinnati. We track all of our officers in terms of their racial stops, and we don't let anybody get out of line, and we use problem solving, and we use a lot of strategies that wouldn't let a minor misdemeanor escalate to a killing. And this is something that, as we go forward in that case, we'll fight hard to make sure that UC comes in line with the broader Cincinnati philosophy. Very, very tragic, very sad.
In your experience, when people say things like, well, you know, it's unfortunate that the prison system looks overwhelmingly black and brown, but frankly, those are the people committing the crimes. And that's why we have police departments to arrest the people committing crimes. So it is not really a racial issue at all. It is a matter that these are the people who make up the vast majority of people committing crimes.
Thank you for asking that, because we hear it all the time, and you have to address that head on. First of all, as early as 1999, the Ohio Supreme Court had a commission that looked at racial justice within the criminal justice and civil justice systems in Ohio and concluded that the incidence of locking up African-American people, people of color, was dramatically disparate and different from their incidence in the community of lawbreakers. So there is no translation between the amount of crime committed by people of color and the amount of people of color locked up as a percentage of the overall total. We have 11% black in Ohio and 54% black in our prison. But more importantly, if you're in the urban core where you have a largely black neighborhood, there may well be a lot of crime in that neighborhood. So the question becomes, how do you respond to it? Do you respond to it by simply, you know, picking off one person after another in a repeat strategy that never gets to the core of the problem? Or do you do something like problem solve, where you go to a hot spot, and rather than just sweep people up, you get to the core of the problem. You tell that landlord to harden the doors, to pick better tenants, to put lights up, to change the traffic pattern, to put up security cameras. You do things that deter crime and disorder. And you do those things instead of arrest, because we don't need to be locking up more people. It isn't working. What works is when we reduce the invitation for crime. Same thing with repeat victims. Cincinnati is the only town that has a problem-solving procedure. We organize all of our service calls by repeat location, repeat perpetrator, and repeat victim. And if you go to the repeat victim column, you might see that there are certain women that are being involved in domestic violence, that they're calling to save their lives repeatedly. Maybe they need services and referrals to agencies that will help them be safe. And if we can do that, we will reduce a lot of the locations where these violent people are hanging out and abusing the other residents in those apartments. So there's a lot of strategies that can be followed that involve social services, that involve a wide array of the type of responses that supplement arrests. Do I say we'll never arrest anybody? Absolutely not. There are people that need to be arrested. There are people that will need to be locked up. But in a just world, that number is so much smaller than what we're doing in our society, and it's so much more balanced racially. And that's what we're working on in Cincinnati, and we'll make a progress.
You've talked in this conversation, you've talked about the cases that you handled and the relationship between those cases and the procedural outcomes and administrative changes and reforms that actually have resulted. Does it bother you that many of the cases, the high-profile cases that we have seen, in those cases, the attorneys have basically taken the tack that what's important is the settlement, a big payout? I have covered many cases in which the attorneys basically have filed zero papers to indicate that these cases should count for something so that nobody else would go through what the victims and the victims' families are going through as a result of police use of force and police brutality. Do you find that you're kind of you're part of a very few people in your profession who are interested in this kind of work?
Well, maybe, but here's the deal. Most of these cases are damage actions, all right? Derek Garner, Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice. I mean, these are all damage actions. Why is that? Can you go to court in those cases and get an injunction against chokeholds, against violence when you're transporting prisoners? No, because your client's dead. He doesn't have standing. He can't allege that he's likely to have this happen to him again. So that discourages many lawyers from seeking that remedy. But it shouldn't. our contract, if you were with me when a family comes to me in our office and they say, my son was killed, my brother was killed, my loved one was killed, they will say to a person, I want fair compensation and I don't want this to happen to anybody else. And there are a lot of lawyers who don't think they can do anything with the second half of that plea. But you can in a damage action. We actually write into our contract, we reflect back to our clients that says, we will seek fair compensation and reform. And we also have in the contract an agreement that the family will not agree to confidentiality, so that that reform can be a source of public education and deterrence in the future. And then when we get to a settlement, if we're going to mediate the case, those reforms are on the table. And we get monuments, we get apologies, we get changes in training, we get all kinds of things because the family insisted on it. If the city refuses to do that and we go to trial, yeah, we only get money. But then the city will say, we want to appeal. And we'll say, now we'll revisit this. If you want to appeal, we'll agree to take less money if you do this, this, and this, reform. And we've done that even after trial. So there are many opportunities, if you keep your ears open and your eyes open, to secure reforms. And the families generally just love it. They can't. Everybody knows you can't bring the dead person back, but they do feel like they've honored their loved one so much more when you combine a substantial recovery. You don't want to give up the amount of money you're going to get because they deserve full compensation, and I'm not going to deny that to anybody, but you want to add to it as much reform as you can, and cities will do that.
Now, to what degree does damage action compare with class action?
Well, we've done class actions, but you have to have a group of people similarly situated who are likely to experience the abuse you're talking about. So if you've got a city that does police in a racially disparate manner and you can prove intentional discrimination based on race, which was one of our allegations in the underlying Cincinnati case, yes, you can get an injunction that will prohibit that practice and order reform. If you, like in our custody cases, it's very similar, where we bring class actions around conditions of confinement in various custodial settings, and where all the prisoners are plaintiffs. So there are opportunities where a class action can really be a great vehicle for reform. But if you've got a police shooting and a decedent, and you're representing the family of a deceased person, that doesn't lend itself to the class action because, like I say, your client doesn't have standing.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Al Gerhardstein, for taking this time to talk with us today. Quite an education. And I am so pleased that you were able to find time in your very busy schedule to talk with us today. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your advocacy, for your work, and for giving voice to these ideas. Take care.
Thank you so much. We'll take a little break and come back and talk about the two-ring circus tonight. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. And CNN takes its turn tonight as Carnival Barker at the two-ring circus. It's calling a presidential debate. And really, I just wanted to remind you, If you should happen to want to torture yourself to actually watch this stuff, that keep the mantra in mind that you're watching a 3M moment. What do I mean by that? I mean media, money, and marketing. So far, although this is the second Republican debate, there is no debate. This is not a debate. Somebody needs to know what a debate actually is. But people ask each other questions and they engage each other. This is a kind of Q&A. It's a show and tell, you know, two media hosts from mega media organizations are going to be asking questions. One of them with CNN, that's Jake Tapper, and the other Hugh Hewitt from the, I think it is the I'm blocking here, on the network, on the Salem Radio Network, which is a Christian network, and he's said to be the big conservative there, among a lineup of conservatives who appear on that network every day. And so we have, it's a mess. But we did say before, long before, I did tell you what this is all about. It's about money. And the money is going to get you the two others. It's going to get you media coverage, and it's going to get you the marketing. And that explains Donald Trump and others. But here is yet another instance in which we have to say the media organizations are playing a really very, very disappointing role in going along with the program instead of doing their business as journalists. If you were doing your business as a journalist, you would know that there isn't anything right now in the works that shows that this contest has truly begun, that there are ideas on the table, that there are serious proposals to be considered, that there are positions being taken. It's just, you know, playing games. They're playing games as a kind of warm-up session. We had Rick Perry falling out of the pack because, guess what? He didn't have money. Now, his ideas may have been very good, but he didn't have the chance to buy the space in order to share those ideas. And this is the game that they're all playing, the media and these politicians. They're all playing the same game. What does that leave you as a conscientious person trying to really get a sense of where things are going here with this race? Just understand, the race has not yet begun. They're playing with your mind. CNN tonight will get some ratings points, which it desperately needs because it is dead last. MSNBC is dead last, but it is trailing way behind. Everybody's trailing way behind Fox News. Fox News is king of the heap. CNN gets its shot to be the ringmaster tonight, and Jake Tapper and Hugh Hewitt will do the job. They will sit side by side and pretend that this is diversity because, you know, we have the so-called liberal Jake Tapper sharing the spotlight with Hugh Hewitt, the conservative. Okay, well, that's nice for marketing purposes, but we don't have a debate. And what are the debates based on? Why are people there? Who qualifies for this debate? I already explained in a previous program how the media decided to take this whole thing away from a group that had been doing these debates for years, and that's the League of Women Voters, who were nonpartisan. And then they decided that they were not going to be part of what they called a fraud on the American people. This process was hijacked by the media, who quickly moved to monetize it. It's not about whether they're doing their job to inform and educate the public about the issues. It is about the fact that they can hijack the process, monetize it, get people to buy ads, and get the candidates to run their ads when the time comes for them to start knocking on doors to find out how much money they're going to get out of each candidate's campaign budget for advertising. That's what this is all about. So the world is expecting a debate, and there won't be one. It's a Q&A, it's show and tell, it's a dog and pony show. And the candidates are chosen according to their polling positions. How are they doing in the polls? That's what determines whether they get to participate in this debate. It has nothing to do about the validity of their ideas or whether they need to be heard or whether the people need to know what's going on and, you know, with their positions. And none of this is really important. It's money, media, and marketing. That's the 3M moment that we are going to be witnessing tonight. If it is any different, I would love somebody to prove to me that I'm wrong. It's a sick joke, actually. But the media should be ashamed of itself, because so far they haven't been really doing journalism. They're just doing the service of providing free coverage so that when the time comes for them to sit across the table with the various campaigns, because I did share with you, it is said that this 2016 presidential election will generate as much as $5 billion in advertising. And all of these media outlets want their fair share of it. So they have been providing free coverage. They've been making nice. They've, you know, every now and then they act like they're actually doing journalism, and they may, you know, do a little investigative piece here. But by and large, mainstream media has just decided that they are extensions of everybody's campaign. And they are biding their time, and they're demonstrating in the meantime why it is they will deserve the lion's share of whatever budget these candidates have, those who last for the real contest when it actually begins. So tonight, I don't know. I don't think I'll be watching, but you never know. But these things, I've become so cynical about it because they do these things so routinely now. They don't even have any conscience. There's no sense of shame about it. It's as if nobody in the newsroom even knows what a news story is anymore. That they can't tell that there's a problem here with the way that they have been covering, quote unquote, this 2016 election cycle. They are just whole hog into it. It's about money. That's primarily what is making all of these news stories, quote, viable, unquote, or people ignoring coverage that really should be before the American public. They're not interested in that. So that's what's going to happen. So the second time around, there will be a big to-do about it. CNN will be able to report the very next day. You know, it's now you could tell how it's going to go. They're going to report the incredible boost in their viewership, and they desperately need it because they staged this presidential debate. It is not presidential, and it is not a debate. Somebody needs to understand what a debate really is. If you've listened to debates, you'll be able to tell there's a vast difference between what a debate is and what is going to happen tonight. But amuse yourselves. You know, tune in if you can. You know, stick around for a couple of minutes and see what's going on there. And you know, the script is written and whatnot, then they'll do their thing and they'll congratulate themselves the next day, and they'll generate even more stories about what a great debate it was. And they will even declare the winner. And it will be all about polls. How many people, how the polling is going now that They had the second debate. How these candidates are doing? Are they doing better in the polls or are they doing worse in the polls? It's that kind of a cynical exercise. In the meantime, just be very careful and don't put too much stock in what is about to happen tonight. Regard it for what it is. These are carnival barkers at the carnival show. It's a touring circus. The primetime folks and the not-so-ready for primetime folks, as they decided, these people will be either in the first group at 6 o'clock or the second group later on. It is cynical, cynical, cynical. So just be careful. This is just a word of warning to you. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure and a great privilege always to be in your company. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com, and we'll see each other tomorrow.
No child left behind. What? You think we all blind? Well, even the blind could have seen her. Aftermath of Katrina. Knew about it right here like it's Congo Square. 82% of Americans don't go nowhere. Now nonsense is dumbass. Talk about snitching. With crime.